Welcome to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Our focus is commercial real estate, exploring vital questions, confronting commercial landlords, property and asset managers, investors, brokers, tenants, and anyone providing services to the industry. Your host is Howard Klein. His commercial real estate practice over 35 years has concentrated on broker, leasing, and property management issues. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented with the sole intent of educating listeners. Howard and his guests are specifically not offering legal advice. If you need legal advice, consult your own counsel. CRE Radio is available live and downloadable anytime at creradio.com. Call in during the live show with your comments or questions, 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue. And now, here's Howard Klein.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to CRE Radio. And today's show is Hot Topics in Green Buildings and Sustainability. And I've got some three great and very impressive guests on today. I have David Pogue, who's with CBRE. And I will have each of them give a very brief description of what it is that they do so that you will be duly impressed. We also have Will Teichman and Constantine Contacosta. I mentioned everybody's name correct, right, gentlemen?
Yes.
Okay, great.
That's well done.
All right, why don't we start?
That's a good start.
That's a good start. Let's keep it going that way. David, why don't you let everybody know what it is that you do, and I'm not going to say why you'd be on the show, but give a little bit about what your responsibilities are at CBRE.
All right. Thanks, Howard. Again, I'm Dave Pogue, and I'm the Global Director of Corporate Responsibility for CBRE. That's a relatively new job for me, in which I'm helping the company with our internal efforts around sustainability and corporate responsibility. But prior to this, to January of this year, I was the Global Director of Sustainability for CBRE and held that role for the last 5 years. And in that role, I was responsible for developing and promoting a variety of sustainability services throughout our platform, primarily in the Americas, but with some work globally. We are a very large property management firm, managing about 750 million square feet of primarily institutional quality property in the Americas. And we also do a lot of corporate work, with probably an equal amount of corporate clients, 750 million to a billion square feet of corporate. So over the past 5 years, I've been working developing programs of sustainable practices in the real estate industry.
Oh, great. And Constantine, why don't you tell us about your titles and what it is that you do?
Sure. So first, thanks, Howard, for having me on the show. This should be fun. So I'm Constantine Contacosta. I wear a number of hats, but I'm Deputy Director of New York University's new Center for Urban Science and Progress, something we're calling CUSP, as well as Founding Director of the Center for the Sustainable Built Environment, which focuses on policy and finance research to accelerate sustainable real estate markets. But most of my time has been spent kind of building this new organization and research institution that is CUSP, which is a unique partnership of universities, a number of industry partners, the national laboratories, and several New York City agencies, with the intent of using essentially information sciences and big data analytics to improve the quality of life in cities. So basically improving the economic efficiency, the resource efficiency, and the resilience of cities. So this has been an interesting project and an area where a lot of my recent research has been on examining some of the implications of the energy disclosure policies that are coming out of many cities, and New York being the first of those, and how that's going to impact commercial real estate markets.
Great. I know that both Will and David have some comments with regard to some things that have been going on in the last 10 days regarding some of the cities. And Will, last but not least, you're with Kimco. Why don't you describe what your responsibilities and title is there?
Thanks, Howard. I'm really excited to be on the show as well, and I indeed am in very good company with David and Constantine. I'm Will Teichman, Director of Sustainability for Kimco Realty Corporation. Kimco is about a 50-year-old company, for those of you who don't know us. We're the nation's largest owner of open-air shopping centers. We own just under 900 properties across 46 states, Puerto Rico, Canada, and Mexico, and that's about 130 million square feet of GLA that we are in some way affiliated with. My role in the company is to lead our corporate responsibility and sustainability programs. I've been with the company just about 2 years, and in my role as Director of Sustainability, I'm really responsible for kind of two aspects of our program. Obviously, a lot of time is spent on strategy and execution associated with the different initiatives that we're working on, whether that be solar energy, energy efficiency, water efficiency, et cetera. And then the rest of my time here, I spend focused on communication, and it's something that I think we'll probably talk a little bit about today, is the rising demands of various stakeholder groups, whether they be large institutional investors, JV partners, tenants, et cetera. And I spend quite a bit of time just explaining what we're doing and engaging directly with those stakeholder groups. Prior to Kimco, I was with Target Corporation in the Twin Cities. And prior to that, I was a management consultant doing sustainability work for large real estate owners. I live in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I'm really excited to be on the show.
Well, great. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being on the show. I am duly impressed with myself for being able to get the three of you on this show. So you don't have to applaud me right now, but it's one of the few times I'll actually pat myself on the back. The three of you are extremely impressive, and I must have come up with, when I interviewed each of you previously, must have come up with about 40 pages worth of notes. Obviously, we can't fit all into this show. So why don't we start out right off the bat? It seemed to me, one of the things that occurred to me from the conversation with each of you was that data has a huge amount to do with all of the green building and sustainability initiatives, if you will. Actually, I think we'll start with Constantine on that, and then everybody can throw in your two cents, if you don't mind. So what does data have to do with all of this, and what is the significance of it?
Well, I think it's a good question, and not just for real estate markets, but just in general. I mean, I think our ability to collect and process data and information is unsurpassed and continues to grow exponentially over time. But I think when it comes down to real estate, I mean, I think sustainability is generally just it's a measurement problem. That, you know, a lot of the things that we're trying to value and better understand, we don't really have a good handle on what are the right metrics and what are the kind of real data points behind that to help people make better and more informed decisions. So this is everything, even just from energy consumption, which has been a major focus for a lot of reasons, but one of it is that it's quite easy to kind of measure consumption and also to value the cost of that consumption. But some of the more difficult ones that I think that we might get into later on, of how you measure indoor air quality and its impact on occupant health, or how you measure the effect of better daylighting on productivity, you know, these kind of impacts that if we could actually quantify in such a way that we can make a case to a broader investor community, I think would really kind of change the game in terms of how people in the real estate market are approaching these type of green building issues.
Well, great. Will, you have any comments? And what about you also, Dave?
Yeah, this is Will. I would say that I agree with Constantine, and that to go a little bit further and I guess kind of add in the perspective of the owner, you know, data is certainly important in terms of measuring impacts and the end effects of the things that we're doing, whether it be, you know, constructing new buildings or less of that in recent years and more around sort of operational impacts associated with buildings, energy use, water use, et cetera. And I think, you know, one distinction that I would like to draw is that, you know, there's a difference between data that helps you to measure the end effect or the impact of what you're doing and data that can help you to prepare to take action. And I know we're going to talk a little bit about building benchmarking laws, and I think, you know, one of the things around those laws specifically is there's some intent to collect information about the impacts. But the key for those laws to really have an impact positively on the way that buildings are run is that owners have to take that information and go the next step. to utilize that information to make better informed decisions about operating their business. And I think today in the current economic environment where there's not a whole lot of new construction going on, there's a lot of focus on operations. And there are multiple data points that we can use as building owners to operate more effectively.
Dave?
Yeah, I'm going to mirror pretty much what the first couple of speakers had spoke about. But for us, the whole quest for data has been going on now for 5 or 6 or 7 years. We started doing this on a very large portfolio of property a number of years ago. We started imposing kind of proposals or programs around sustainability, things like benchmarking and wanting people to do to improve their water use and recycling and a variety of those things. And we got our owners to be engaged in that. We got our property managers to be engaged at it. And at the beginning, although there was certainly a cost element, particularly around energy, this was viewed as the right thing to do, and it was exciting, and it was kind of the new thing around sustainability. But as we got into the program 2 years or 3 years, and we started getting buildings Energy Star labeled, we got buildings LEED certified, and our clients had spent money to do this, our managers had spent time, we began getting this hard question about, okay, now I did it. What's it worth? What did I gain by doing that? And so early on, about 4 years ago, we began a longitudinal study with the University of San Diego and McGraw-Hill looking at a portfolio of sustainable buildings. And I know we'll have a discussion about what is a sustainable building, but we had a core of about 160 buildings in 10 markets, and we were trying to find those answers because we thought if we could find empirical data about the impact of a sustainable building versus a normal building, that it could help drive the industry. And we were part of a growing field of data points. That there's a whole lot of surveys. There's been work done by Constantine. There's been work done by Niels Koch and others, and UC Berkeley and Gary Pivo, and the University of San Diego. All of that building little bits of information. I know that you had said earlier when we were just on the line together about people are asking questions already, is there a value proposition there? We need to know that. And frankly, at this moment, we don't quite know that. We don't know that these buildings, that our information would show that they perform better, but those are on relatively small survey sets. And so the matters of energy cost, of performance, of whether or not they're better occupied or have better renewal rates, these are very important aspects that would then lead to value as well. And then the whole matter of productivity and occupational health, these are the real holy grails to this. And so there's a whole number of areas that if we could find really good empirical data, it would move past the point of this just being kind of the right thing to do because it feels good to the right thing to do because it's economically viable.
Well, great. When we come back after these messages, we're going to talk a little bit about where the state of, and not to misuse the word, where the state of data accumulation is and what the problems are. So, gentlemen, if you don't mind, we're going to take a short break to hear from some of our sponsors.
Manage a shopping center? Always looking for new ideas? Tactics. Tactics Magazine is the idea magazine for shopping center marketing directors all over the world. Exciting promotions, gift with purchase programs, and full-blown ad campaigns. Every edition of Tactics is packed with features, ideas, and news you can use to get the word out and grow your numbers. How can you manage a shopping center without your tactics? Log on to tacticsmagazine.com. Today would be good. tacticsmagazine.com. If you're a retail tenant, you really should belong to the NRTA. They're an organization of the tenants, by the tenants, and for the tenants. Whether you manage a large portfolio or just a mom and pop, the National Retail Tenants Association is on your side. NRTA exists to protect retail tenants everywhere and to make sure landlord billings are correct. Don't wait for your next statement of CAM charges to arrive. Log on to retailtenants.org. That's retailtenants.org. Find out more today.
Welcome back to CRE Radio, and I have with me my guests are Will Teichman, David Pogue, and Constantine. Oh, I got to look at your last name, Constantine Costa. Contacosta.
Contacosta.
I knew I would mess it up. I knew. There we go.
2 out of 3 is good. 2 out of 3.
Oh, at least so. And before we get back to our conversation, I just want to mention two things. One is, if you have any comments or questions, you can leave those comments or questions. Send them to us on Twitter. We've already got a couple of questions on Twitter at that's the @CRE Radio. And also, you can go to our website and go to creradio.com/greenshow, where you can leave comments directly on the particular show posting. And one final thing I do want to mention is that, and I'm very proud of this, we've recently entered into a partnership with IREM OC, and we will be working with the Institute of Real Estate Management over the next year, promoting them and working with them. Absolutely great organization. So let's go on further now. We were at the point where we were talking about collection of data. Where are we at with the data, and what are the problems that we're encountering? Whoever would like to start, go right ahead. Someone took a breath.
Well, this is Will. I guess I'll start, and then I can pass the mic over to the other guys. But I guess the first thing that I would say is, where most companies start, and David alluded to this, is we start with operational impacts. As Constantine was saying, energy, for example, is one of the easiest things to measure. You can, if all else fails, you can print out a stack of utility bills, and you can capture the information from those bills in terms of your cost and consumption on a monthly basis. So I think that's where a lot of us start. And in terms of Kimco and our portfolio of 900 centers, that's certainly where we've started. We started by starting to collect information on those impacts, water, waste, recycling, energy, to understand how each of those properties is performing on a day-to-day, on a month-to-month, on a year-to-year basis. And that helps us to establish a baseline of performance, understand how each asset is behaving month-to-month and year-to-year, but also provides us with the ability to benchmark ourselves, properties in California versus properties in New York, properties in Florida versus properties in Washington State, and to understand how those different properties perform in terms of those different impact measures. So that's one of the places where we've started. And I think in order to, as I was saying earlier, move from just measuring impacts to taking action, we've started to pair that type of information with other information. For example, one of the things that Kimco has undertaken over the last several years is to conduct more comprehensive property surveys of each of our shopping centers. And so we're collecting detailed information on some of the operational characteristics and equipment that's present on the property. So for example, we now have lighting surveys that document the types of fixtures, the circuitry, the wiring on our sites, and we can marry up that information with our energy use to try to identify good target sites for lighting retrofits, as an example.
Is anyone having any difficulty with the tenants cooperating with providing data? I guess that's a no.
Well, let me comment on that. A lot of the work has been done, the most high-profile work has been done in multi-tenant office buildings, where, and frankly, this is one of the areas that we're most interested in trying to get tenant data on those properties that have separately metered spaces. But in most of the markets that we're working in, most of the buildings that we did the work with the University of San Diego that I mentioned earlier, these are multi-tenant office buildings where we control a single meter. So in those cases, we don't need to rely upon the tenant to give us a whole lot of data. Where the next work has to happen, and frankly, there's a whole matter of kind of thought around the whole efficacy of separately metering spaces, and I think that's a whole topic that we can discuss here, but it's one of the things that we're going to be looking at in our Real Green Research Challenge, is trying to determine what the true efficacy is in those spaces, in those buildings, where the tenant is responsible for their meter. And obviously then it adds to your question about how do you get that data back from them. But by and large, we're really concerned with the whole issue about do separately metered spaces, do tenants in metered buildings, do they have lower energy use because they have a much more vested income or interest in the outcome of that. So if they do a good job, then they get the benefit of it. So that's an issue that we're concerned about.
And Howard, in our world, in the retail world, we're pretty much sitting on the opposite side of the fence that David just described, because you know the triple net lease, which is the prevailing structure used in our type of building class, means that most of our tenants are individually metered. They pay their own utility bill, and so we have very little visibility today into what their use characteristics are, what their behavior is inside of those spaces. And when it comes to capital investments and recovery for those investments, we also have obviously challenges, the classic landlord-tenant divide in terms of split incentives when it comes to retrofitting those spaces. And so when I talk about data collection within our portfolio, I'm really referencing at least our initial efforts have been focused around collecting data on those meters that we're responsible for and we pay, which, is a variety of different meters, but I would say the large majority of those meters are either for common areas of the shopping center or for vacant tenant spaces that we control during the period that they're vacant and prior to being released.
Well, does that affect the reliability of the data? Well, maybe I should ask the question. I was thinking of asking this before, and maybe we can start with Constantine. Where do you see the reliability of the data at this point?
Well, yeah, that's a great question and a key question. I mean, I think what we're seeing, in addition to kind of the steps that Kimco and CBRE are doing to collect information, and some other organizations like ULI, Greenprint Center, we're starting to see now this proliferation of the energy disclosure requirements that cities are now adopting. And a lot of my work has been with the city of New York and kind of their policy, which was one of the first, actually the first, which requires all buildings over 50,000 square feet, all commercial buildings, which includes multifamily, to report their energy and water consumption every year. So we're now into the second year of data. We have on the order of about 16,000 buildings worth, which is a really substantial number when you consider some of the alternative data sets. And, I think one of the challenges has been that the data piece on the sustainability and energy side has been very fragmented, that lots of individual companies and nonprofits and cities have very good information, but nobody is really aggregating it all that well into a nice, big, usable data set. But to your question, I think that we're seeing, kind of three challenges, and one is certainly on collection. And the collection of data comes from a number of reasons. One is, as David was pointing out, about sub-metering of spaces. This is a challenge that it's hard to get individual tenant level data. So we're looking at whole building data rather than individual tenant usage. Now in New York City, they passed something called the Greener Greater Buildings Plan, which includes a sub-metering requirement by 2025 for all large spaces. All large tenant spaces, I believe over 10,000 square feet, will have to be sub-metered by 2025. So this is going to really change the game. It's going to take a little while, but it will. And then we have collection problems really in terms of just issues of where the owners are getting this information and how it's being inputted. It creates a lot of scenarios or a lot of opportunities for human error and just not necessarily understanding the definition of the data that's supposed to be entered or what's supposed to be entered or what's supposed to be provided. So I think that there's a question about quality that is, and I can tell you from looking at just the 2 years of data we have for New York City, one of the great things from these policies is that the quality is getting better. I mean, people, the owners, the real estate community is figuring this out. And I think the education and awareness process that goes hand in hand with these kind of mandatory disclosure policies is really going to make a big difference in terms of how usable this data is at the end of the day to actually affect how people are making their decisions.
I agree with Constantine on this matter, and it is a real difficult issue. Even now, we had mandated, as I said earlier, to do every building over 50,000 square feet back a number of years ago, an office building that had to benchmark, register and benchmark with EPA Energy Star and monthly put up their data. Anytime we pull our portfolio manager, and this is probably a bad thing to be saying on a public forum here, but anytime we pull the whole data set of 1,400 buildings or so, anywhere 20% or more of that data is inaccurate. It's either untimely, that it's too, they've gone too long putting the data in, they have errors in the data. So there is a real problem with accuracy. Now, there are a number of ways that you can work around that, and we've been working internally on a process where we can take the data right from the utility bills after it's been paid through our accounting process and upload the data directly, taking the responsibility away from the property manager or for the engineer. It's, you know, frankly, these folks have lots of things to do, and this is oftentimes one of the last that they think of. So to take that off of their hands would be a real a good thing for us to do. So we're working on a process of that. But also many utility companies are looking to directly upload the data as well. And so I agree with Constantine that we need to improve the accuracy, but the sense now that there are so many of these disclosure laws, and with some penalty and with some opportunity for failure, and that I think we are getting better, and the industry is looking for ways to be better at getting cleaner data uploaded the first time.
I would have to say that just to throw something out, has anybody seen any leases that require the tenants to provide data? I mean, now this is something, obviously, as an attorney who deals with commercial leases, there are provisions occasionally where financial data has to be provided by the tenant on a regular basis. What about energy data, particularly where the information is, the utilities are submetered? Has anybody seen any of that occurring?
Well, this is Will. One of the things that I'll say is that although we haven't seen a lot of that language creeping into leases thus far, one of the things that we are actively discussing here within Kimco is the need to secure release waivers upon lease execution from new tenants. And the reason for that is, as David was alluding to, is that, you know, utility companies, for example, PG&E in California, and the building benchmarking law that affects all properties in the state of California, PG&E and the other IOUs are responsible for directly transmitting that information to EPA Energy Star, which is the established benchmarking tool that most of these laws are utilizing. And so from the landlord's perspective, the critical piece of information that we need to get from the tenant is we need to get a release from them, which is essentially a release form with the utility company that enables us at a single point in time to set up that feed of information related to their meter. And if we can get that piece of information secured on new leases and not necessarily putting it into the lease language, but actually sort of doing that as a parallel process, we think that we'll be well set up over time as leases roll over to be able to do the type of whole building disclosure that is being asked in California, New York, and other municipalities.
This is what I love about doing the show. I always learn something new. I've never seen something like that, and it's a great idea, and I will talk that up some more at a later time. We need to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about who the stakeholders are. And what I mean by that is, who's driving this initiative? Are the tenants? Are the landlords? We had some prior conversations about Sarbanes-Oxley. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that, because without the financial component, the cost-benefit analysis, there has to be something driving this, and while I like to believe that it's everybody understands that environmental concerns are important, I don't think that's going to, for the most part, being the driving factor. So, without further ado, let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about that.
If you need anything with your company logo on it, you need Monogram Magic. T-shirts, ball caps, polo shirts, anything. Monogram Magic does it beautifully, does it right, and does it right on time. For over 20 years, Monogram Magic has produced corporate apparel your people will be proud to wear. Large orders or small, it's all about attention to detail. See for yourself. Here's the website, logostolife.com. That's L-O-G-O-S, the number 2, then L-I-F-E.com. Logostolife.com. What's next for commercial real estate and retail marketing? Pop-up retail. And it's here now. PopUpInsider.com is the premier online resource for owners to advertise and fill properties for temporary use. PopUpInsider.com is where merchants and brands shop for temporary locations. See for yourself. Go to PopUpInsider.com, create your own account, market your empty spaces, or view available locations for your business. All on one convenient site, PopUpInsider.com.
Before the break, we were about to get into the topic of who the stakeholders are. And one of the things that I wanted to get to is, what's driving this initiative? Is it a profit-driven initiative, or are there other interests? David, why don't we start with you?
Well, you know, there's a whole host of reasons why people have gotten involved in this. Why the clients have gotten involved in it. When we were first starting with this, we actually had clients who were pushing us further forward. Oftentimes, they have shareholders or money interests that think this is important, and so they were concerned. I mean, when you really step back a little bit and just look at the impact of commercial real estate and real estate in general on the on global climate change issues, whether it's emissions or water use or energy use or all of those things, it was clear several years ago that commercial real estate was certainly at the forefront of a lot of these issues. And so a lot of our clients began being concerned about that. Their investors were concerned. And so part of it was driven by this view that it was the right thing to do. There has now been this growing sense, though, and again, there have been some studies, but not enough, that these folks, our clients, now do feel also, though, that this is economically the right thing to do as well. They're energy efficient, they're saving money. By and large, most things on conservation will be cheaper, whether it's less water or less energy. And so it's an economic kind of viewpoint as well. But they also are concerned about who their end user is. More and more tenants, particularly in, you know, it's not every market, and I think as we talk about this, it's like everybody's the same in this, and it's not. There's pretty much of a bifurcated market. It's the higher profile buildings, higher profile clients, more coastal kinds of cities. But in those places, clients are demanding these kinds of buildings as well. Most clients who are now concerned about sustainability or CSR, one of the ways that they can demonstrate that they're doing something about it is by occupying a sustainable building. So they're beginning to seek these kinds of buildings. So if you want those kinds of tenants, you need to play in this game. And then the final thing that I'll add here is that there's now a new program, and most folks on the call I'm sure are aware of this, but called GRESB, the Global Real Estate Sustainability Benchmark. This is a new protocol that came out of the Netherlands about 3 years ago, and it's at the fund level. And it's now companies are demonstrating back to their owners or to their shareholders their sustainable characteristics, and they're starting to get graded on this. And so that's going to be also something in this that begins driving this. When the actual money is concerned about it, then the people who develop and own buildings have to be concerned about it. So it's multifaceted depending on where you are and what the buildings are, but I think each of those elements plays a role.
Will, what's driving Kimco in this regard?
Well, I would obviously agree with David's comments in general, and I think just to expand upon one of those points, the investor community has been very proactive in directly engaging Kimco in conversations about sustainability and corporate responsibility. I honestly don't know all of the reasons for that. I can say that I think if you look at the some of the dominant players when it comes to the investment community, particularly investors in commercial real estate, there are many large institutional investors, pension funds, insurance companies, who are very sophisticated companies, you know, in their own right, And a lot of these companies have their own sustainability initiatives. For example, Prudential is a huge investor in real estate, and they have a CEO mandate to establish sustainability as a priority. And it's not just because they want to be green, you know, because they think that's something that is advantageous for their brand. I think it really comes down to three things as we talk to large institutional investors, three concerns that they're looking to address. And those three concerns are the following. One, they feel that sustainably built and sustainably operated real estate assets perform better. They feel that over time the performance of those assets potentially will outperform other comparable assets. They feel that there is a risk mitigation opportunity when you go with companies who are sustainable, operate with sustainability in mind and with corporate responsibility in mind. And then third, they feel that there is the potential for just an overall higher asset quality and asset valuation when it comes to the actual underlying assets that they're taking a stake in through their investment. So institutional investors have, you know, directly engaged with Kimco in dialogues. We've also obviously received a lot of the same types of investor surveys, such as GRESB. The Carbon Disclosure Project is another big one. It's not specific to real estate, but it's focused on all of the largest companies globally. And these are things that are taken very, very seriously, you know, by our senior management team, by our board. And I think it's probably for a lot of companies has been, specifically publicly traded companies, it's been one of the very first things to hit the radar screen and caused a lot of us to, you know, start to get more organized, start to collect data on performance, and ultimately to start to impact change in terms of how we're operating our business.
And Howard, this is Constantine. Just to kind of continue on that thought, I think there's two other players involved. I mean, one is the cities themselves. I mean, we're seeing kind of cities as the key actor here in terms of doing something about climate change or carbon reductions. And you're starting to see these carbon reduction policies kind of proliferate across cities, and with it policies to affect energy consumption in buildings and carbon from buildings. So I think that's what's also catalyzing some of these push factors in the new regulations, both, you know, the ones that are now most cities are passing that their own municipal buildings have to be LEED certified or have to be green, but also in terms of creating a market and encouraging the private sector to actually kind of follow suit. And I think what that's doing, to Will's point, is also creating another kind of risk mitigation factor for owners and investors, which is, you know, there's this concern about compliance risk that we start with. You know, if cities are starting to ask for data, it's only a matter of time before they start benchmarking building to building and telling people who's got a bad building and who's got a good building, and kind of forcing the bad ones to get up to speed. And I think there's a concern about, you know, waiting until you're actually forced to do something to improve your building at a time when it might be much more costly or much more difficult to do that. And then the kind of the second player in all of this is really the utilities. I mean, if you look at New York City, you know, Con Ed has very little capacity, in fact, hardly any additional generation or transmission capacity. So there's just a fundamental supply constraint that you really, you know, Con Edison and the utility company has to reduce the amount of energy it's delivering. So that's where they're coming in, at least trying to start putting some incentives and some money into play here to affect the kind of the decisions of the owners and the tenants a little bit more.
Hmm. Yeah, you know, in earlier conversations with the three of you, and I'm not sure who had mentioned it, but there was a comment that there's a sense that an owner that is paying attention to the sustainability of their buildings and is paying attention to that whole aspect, that is just a part of perhaps the overall evidence of the quality of the management of the building and how they're taking care of the building, and that they're for buyers, that there may be that sense that the building is better maintained.
So, well, I would weigh in on that, and that is certainly the case, that this is an element of just high profile care and concern and good sponsorship on a building owner's behalf. In fact, we're always finding ways to demonstrate that and to make it part of the marketing profile of a property. Because I do think that if you do that, then you probably do other things well. And to some degree, there's a little bit of a double-edged sword here. We were talking earlier about buildings, these types of buildings having a higher value. There's always the concern when you go out, and even if the indications are that that building might sell for more, there's always a question about how much of that increase in value came because of the sustainability aspects and how much of it was really there as a result of a variety of things that an owner was doing and the management team, et cetera, were doing to make that building perform better in the marketplace.
And Howard, David, sorry.
Go ahead, Will. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think if you zoom out from the individual property level and think about the company level from an investor's perspective, I think there is absolutely a feeling that companies who are embracing sustainability and not just embracing sustainability in terms of, you know, putting out a corporate responsibility report, but truly embracing, I guess, the underlying philosophy of using this as a lens to uncover new business opportunities and to run their business more effectively, I think there is a growing group of investors out there who view those companies as well-managed companies. They view the senior executive teams, the leadership teams who are at the helm of those companies as being with it, you know, understanding what's moving the market and understanding kind of the long-term factors that are going to impact their businesses. And I wouldn't be surprised if you were to go out and talk to some of the what are described as SRI, socially responsible investors in the SRI investment community. I think that's what a lot of those investors are thinking, you know, as they look to invest in companies that are, you know, quote unquote sustainable, is they're looking for companies who kind of get it. They get that long-term vision of what a well-managed company looks like. And it's not just sustainability, but sustainability is certainly one of those factors.
Constantine, you were about to say something.
Yes, yeah, I was just going to kind of emphasize David's point, and I think this comes back to both the value proposition here and also the data, which is, you know, I think that a lot of the studies that have been done, and I think to their credit, because they really changed the discussion about this whole question of is there value and some kind of economic return for a green building, but most of those were done looking at, you know, basically looking at the value of a label, whether it be LEED or Energy Star, but particularly the LEED studies. And I think now we're recognizing that the problem with measuring the value of a LEED certified building is that it's hard to disaggregate what's going on behind that label that people are actually valuing. Is it just because it's, you know, a Class A building, or is it because it has because it's better managed, or is it because of the actual energy performance? So some of the things that we're able to do now, and of course you could control for some of those factors, but some of the things we're able to do now with this kind of actual data we're getting out of buildings is to see if there's a value proposition behind actual energy performance. So looking at the real performance of the building and seeing how that's translating down to the bottom line. And that's not something you can necessarily do just by looking at, you know, the implication of a particular eco label.
That's very interesting. What we have some questions at this moment that we've gotten on Twitter that I'd like to address. Michael MBA, actually, who is a property manager that I used to work with, he used to be with Cassidy Turley. And Michael, I'm sorry, I forgot your last name, and if I remembered it, or send me a Twitter tweet letting me know, I would mention it on the radio. But he asked, where can landlords or property owners find sources of funding for green building projects? Would any of the three of you know that answer?
Well, to Constantine's earlier point about the utilities, by and large, utilities everywhere are facing the same issue that Constantine related. I don't think it's quite as difficult as the New York situation, but in most places it is. And the utilities have been at the forefront of trying to help buildings improve their energy performance with a variety of programs, including coming in first and doing either benchmarking or audits or even doing a retro commissioning effectively for free. and then helping them for a variety of projects, dependent upon the, whether it's lighting or controls or whatever. So I would think the first place to look is to go to the local utility and see what programs they're promoting at that moment. And they do change, and they have a certain amount of money, and then people come in and take it all, and then they wait another 6 months for another program. So you need to be pretty active in that and get in the queue. But that's the first place that I would look.
And my answer to Michael would be that I think, you know, we're just on the cusp of having some new tools in our toolkit, hopefully, that will arrive soon and potentially enable landlords and tenants to get more things done in terms of retrofit specifically. I'll give you an example. I actually have a printed out copy of a state bill from the state of California, SB 37, which is California Clean Energy Consumer Access Act of 2013. And this is a proposed Senate bill in California. And it's basically proposing a structure that's known as on-bill repayment. And basically what that means is that a third-party financier would be able to come to the table and provide capital to invest in, for example, a lighting retrofit, an HVAC retrofit, or another building improvement such as solar energy, and that third-party capital would be able to come to the table, invest in that, and the repayment mechanism would basically essentially take place through the utility bill. And it solves a lot of potential issues associated with being able to secure that type of capital. For small retail tenants, for example, this would enable small retailers to be able to access financing for these types of projects that have the real possibility of, you know, reducing their operating expenses when it comes to energy, and doing it in a way that you know, on a month-to-month basis doesn't present an increased operating expense for their business as they're slowly paying off the cost of that retrofit through a utility bill. And the fact that the OBR mechanism is being considered in California would also allow those financing charges to extend beyond the life of an individual tenant in a space. So the project would live with the meter, essentially, and not the individual occupant of the space, which would solve for some of the short-term lease issues that are currently prevalent in retail buildings, definitely, that would prevent a tenant from being able to take on a project that has perhaps a little bit of a longer payback period. So that's one example of the mechanism. Obviously, it's, you know, something that's being proposed. It's not in place yet, but I think there are a lot of different forces, perhaps the largest of which is institutional investors and capital, which recognize that, just like they have in the solar energy industry over the last several years, that energy efficiency projects present a very attractive investment opportunity. And so they're now sort of trying to figure out what mechanisms could be put in place to be able to, from the investor perspective, invest in those projects. And obviously from a societal perspective, and a utility perspective, be able to get more of those types of projects done in these types of commercial buildings where, at least historically to date, really not a lot of activity has taken place.
Another similar vehicle is the PACE financing.
That was easy for you to say.
I was so anxious to say this. There is the PACE financing protocol that's been out, and it's been in the marketplace now for several years, and it's run into a variety of roadblocks. But it has a similar sort of on-bill payment process to do a variety of energy efficiency programs, including solar. The method of payment there, repayment there, would be on the tax bill. And county by county, different places are putting this in place and allowing this to happen. And as Will suggests, there's literally billions of dollars on the sideline right now of investor money that is ready and looking to do these kinds of investments. But there has been the whole concern about how do you really monetize that, securitize that, and get the payment over time. But between the California bill, which I was not aware of, on utility bill or on the tax bill, those are good ways that could help, particularly these smaller buildings that don't have a good source of capital.
But also there's a common element here, too, that, you know, a lot of the kind of financing tools that are out there these days are really kind of structured around the problem of lack of information asymmetries, right? So once we get more information about how a retrofit will actually perform and how much savings you'll get with a high degree of reliability,
you know, you will be able to securitize these types of loans and go to more traditional lenders to actually get these types of retrofit loans for commercial buildings. And you may not need all of these other kind of municipal and utility level kind of intermediaries, if you will, into this market. And you might be able to kind of use more traditional capital markets. But to Michael's question, just a quick practical follow-up on that. And we do some work with the Department of Energy. They have a great database called the DSIR database, the Database of State Incentives for Renewables and Efficiency. And it basically aggregates and just collects all of the different state and local incentives that are out there for energy efficiency projects. So if you need a place to go, go to the website there, and that's a good one-stop resource.
See, when you pronounced it DSIR. See, I didn't want to call it DSIR because I don't want someone to go on the wrong website here.
Yeah,
it's
a very controversial website, and make sure you enter the right words in.
Yeah, DSIR.
Yeah. Now, was that you, Will?
It's a common joke.
Oh yeah. Well, you wasn't it you that warned me before the show that you're a bit of a wild card? You know, and you have to start
say. Fortunately, that was me, and I'm glad that you've now put this all out to Will, so I've avoided being shamed by him.
I'm getting confused. So, gentlemen, we again need to take a break, and then I want to address a couple of other questions, and then get to we're not even going to be able to get close to fulfilling everything that I've listed in my outline, and there are some questions that really are enough fodder for shows on their own, where J.R. Nolan 12, for example, wants to know more information about LED certified buildings. We'll probably have a separate show just on LED certified buildings. But when we come back from the break, I want to talk about what is a green building, because I've seen advertisements where, you know, they go, I'm a green building, or I'm LED certified, so if you want to save the environment, live here or work here, and a bunch of times it's just a bike rack. So I'd like to talk about that and what all that means as soon as we come back.
And one of us will correct the LED thing to LEED, so go on.
Oh, okay.
Techniques Marketing can help you do more business with your biggest clients. We've developed exciting ways to increase your revenue streams with your key accounts, way beyond mere trial and error. And we've done it for some of the biggest companies in America. If you're happy with your numbers, great. If not, we should talk. Techniques Marketing, TECH, that's the tech, NIQUES, there you've got your NEEKS, TechniquesMarketing.com. Techniques Marketing can help you do more business with your biggest clients. We've developed exciting ways to increase your revenue streams with your key accounts, way beyond mere trial and error. And we've done it for some of the biggest companies in America. If you're happy with your numbers, great. If not, we should talk. Techniques Marketing, TECH, that's the tech, NIQUES, there you've got your NEEKS, TechniquesMarketing.com.
Manage a shopping center? Always looking for new ideas? Tactics. Tactics Magazine is the idea magazine for shopping center marketing directors all over the world. Exciting promotions, gift with purchase programs, and full-blown ad campaigns. Every edition of Tactics is packed with features, ideas, and news you can use to get the word out and grow your numbers. How can you manage a shopping center without your tactics? Log on to tacticsmagazine.com. Today would be good. TacticsMagazine.com.
Welcome back to CRE Radio. I'm your host. This is Howard Klein, and we have as our guests Will Teichman, David Pogue, and Konstantin Kontakosta. Guys, did I do that
well
right?
Done. Yeah, it did. It only took an hour.
Go.
Now we'll work on LED.
So. LED. Is it LED or LEEDS?
Neither.
Neither. Okay.
It's LEED.
LEED. But if you say LEED certification, you add the apostrophe S?
Lead certified. Yeah, okay. I believe Leeds is a city somewhere near London.
It very well could be. So you see, what I get to do, gentlemen, is I get to go on the radio and express my ignorance, which is why I have the three of you in order to correct me. So while we're talking about informing me, could you tell me what a green building is and what sustainability means? And from now, in the clearest way possible, why don't we start with Will?
Oh, great. Go ahead and pitch me the hardest question.
Spinning dial, and your name showed up first.
Well, I'll take one of two questions, and then I'll pass the mic to someone else to answer. And I guess the one that I'll choose to to start with is what is a green building? And I guess I'd like to take issue with that question a little bit, or perhaps to turn it on its head somewhat, and to say that I think that there's a lot of discussion about what constitutes a quote-unquote green building, when really the conversation should be about greener buildings. And what I mean by that is that I don't think there is no such thing as a green building, just like there's no such thing as a green consumer product. There is no definition of what constitutes a 100% green building, and it's not a binary yes-no type decision. There are certainly certifications out there, such as LEED certification or Energy Star certification, that help you to put a badge on a building that is indicative of the fact that it's greener, but there is no such thing as a green building today. Now, what is a greener building? Well, I think that's a more interesting conversation. I think there's a lot of different roads you could go down and discuss. Obviously, a lot of the focus to date has been around energy. David and Constantine have, I think, very astutely identified the fact that, energy just happens to be one of those consumptive items that has an environmental impact that also happens to have dollars associated with it. So it's relatively easy for us to assign a value to it. But there are any number of other environmental attributes that I think would be encompassed within a green building. And, LEED, for example, as a standard, does a very good job of identifying what some of those different categories are, whether it be water consumption, whether it be energy consumption, whether it be indoor air quality. Those are some of the things that a standard such as LEED attempts to address. So, I guess what I would say is that greener buildings is what we should be striving for. There are ways that we can measure that, we should, absolutely be heading down that road, but I'm not necessarily sure what the end destination is.
David?
Well, I think Will did a great job of that, so I might add a couple of points to this, that when generally the economics folks or the academics folks are looking at this and trying to do a green building index or looking at the amount of green space, quote unquote, in a market relative to another market, typically they will identify, as Will had pointed out, those badged buildings, Energy Star labeled or LEED certified in whatever fashion, and that becomes kind of the green building stock when they're comparing market to market. But I agree that they're all shades of green. In fact, it's interesting. We're actually looking, I may talk about this later if we have time, but this program that we've gone on called the Real Green Research Challenge, where we as an organization are funding academic research in a variety of areas trying to find some of these answers. One of the things that we've been seeking for years, and that's a personal passion of mine, is to try to find some sort of an index akin to a FICO score or something of that nature that every building could have a relative score. You're a 620 or you're a 740, again, liken it to your credit score. And so that at some point you can say if you're a 700 and above that you could be called a sustainable or green building. And so every building, whether they're participating in a LEED process or they have an Energy Star label, they would have their number, their score, and you could have a way of judging them. Because frankly, right now, it's a bit of a crapshoot.
Constantine, and before I ask you the question, Constantine, if I might, I think you should speak to David about possibly funding some of your research and everything.
Well, I've actually got some work I'm going to send him that actually does exactly what he was looking for. So
there you go.
Separate conversation. But you know, to that point, I think that Will and David covered it well in terms of what a green building is, and I think to Will's point and to both points, so that it's really the relative measure that's important. I mean, we're getting fixated on a kind of yes, no, is it green, is it not green, and that's not really how the market plays, and that's not really how we can begin to compare buildings. So one of the things that I've been working on is really a better way to evaluate the efficiency of, particularly the efficiency of buildings in relation to a number of the building characteristics and to kind of the output of the building. Because it's not just, you know, we can't just look at the amount of energy a building is using per square foot and compare that to another building, and because one is higher, that's the worse building or the less green building. It's not that simple. You have to understand, you know, who are the tenants in the building, how many people are in that building, because it's the people in these buildings that are really using the energy. It's not the buildings themselves. So there's all of these other factors that come into creating this kind of credit score, if you will, kind of the FICO score that David is talking about, that thankfully now that through these disclosure laws and these other data sources that we're actually able to create. So one of the things that I've been doing with the city is doing just that, creating a reliable, relevant, relative measure that will actually allow you to compare two buildings accurately, you know, based on the tenancy, based on the building age, based on the construction material, so you could really get to understand who's a better performer, who's a worse performer, and then begin to address it. Because it's really not just as simple as who's using more or less energy. There's a lot more that's going into that based on what's happening within the building.
Now, you raise an interesting point, Constantine, on the issue of what the building materials are. Is there any consideration with regard to carbon footprint, which is just a wide open question, but how much attention when you're trying to determine a green building or how green a building is or the sustainability initiative, how much attention is actually paid to how much energy was used to create the building or in the first place, the materials used?
So there is a decent amount of that, I think, especially in the obviously new construction. And LEED, to its credit, one of the things that it involves, one of the kind of categories within the LEED certification process, is something on materials and resources. So understanding kind of the level of volatile organic compounds, for example, within a material, and the embodied energy within that material. So the, you know, how much energy it took to extract and ship it from where it was extracted to where it's going to be built, you know, those kind of issues. So this is, you know, something that's starting to take hold. It's called life cycle cost analysis. So where you're really looking at the entire kind of soup to nuts from, you know, extracting the raw material out of the ground, putting on a truck, delivering it to the construction site, you know, erecting it, and then how long it will actually last in terms of its survivability, you know, measuring the kind of carbon emissions throughout that entire process and the costs associated with that entire process. Now, obviously, these are complex calculations, so it's not the average developer is not necessarily doing this yet, but we're starting to see, especially kind of the federal government and some of its construction projects and some of the more sophisticated developers starting to actually pay attention to these type of measures.
You know, this is akin to something that Walmart, you're probably aware, Walmart is trying to do something similar with all of their consumer products that they're selling in their stores, trying to get this life cycle cost analysis, you know, whether it's a loaf of bread or a shirt made out of cotton that was grown in Egypt, or to try to go all the way back to the source, identify all the products and all the materials and all the shipping and how it came here, how it's used, and how the after use is, and to give it a relative score. They're trying to do that on 365,000 products. So you can see that there's a great complexity in this whole issue, but it is certainly one that has captured the imagination of people who are concerned. Because it's like the idea that you go out tomorrow and get a new Prius, which is probably a very efficient car, which it is, I have to have one. But if you got rid of a four-year-old car, what happened to all the embedded energy and emissions and all into making that car, you know, so it's not as simple a proposition as it might appear on the surface.
No. Okay, so the next question, the next question that I have, is there a difference between sustainability and a green building?
Well, I might argue that sustainability is really almost a process, a thought process and a way of doing things. And in the end, you hope to get a greener building through the process of there. And, you know, so again, these are almost interchangeable, unfortunately, amorphous kinds of words that are out there. But I think sustainability is just more of a mindset and the process of the way doing things.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about what our governments are doing. We should probably start with Constantine on this issue. Is what is generally going on with regard to the cities? I understand there's, AB 1130 in California. There's something going on in Chicago. What is our government doing in a going forward basis? Constantine, why don't you start, because you're directly involved in this.
Sure, yeah. So, you know, this is a good question. And we're typically seeing most of the action happening at the city level, with some happening at the states. Obviously, California is very active. And obviously less so at the federal government level. And there's reasons for that with respect to commercial real estate. And one is that both zoning and building codes are very local, and that either you have a situation where, like in New York, where the city controls the building code, or in most states where the states control it. So a lot of these kind of policy mechanisms and code mechanisms you have to kind of change the how people build and design buildings are at these local levels. So we're seeing a few things. I mean, over the past 10 years or so, we saw a pretty dramatic uptick in the number of cities and states that actually required or provided incentives for LEED certified or Energy Star certified buildings within their locality. So San Francisco, for instance, has a policy that any new commercial building has to be, a LEED Gold certified building if it's above a certain size. So we're starting to see that for new construction. I think what's more interesting, and because of the focus on existing buildings and their impact on the environment, that we're starting to see this kind of increase in the number of these energy disclosure laws, and what led in New York and then followed to San Francisco and Chicago is considering it now. Boston just signed, or actually Philadelphia just signed, and I think Boston is considering it. So there's about seven cities now that have these energy disclosure policies. And these are really interesting because they're not necessarily about mandating people to do things outside of reporting energy consumption, but more, I think, especially in New York, around creating a market, providing that information so that people can then start competing on the energy performance of their building, so that the tenants and the investors could start asking the questions, which will then hopefully kind of change market behavior over time. So I think that's really where we're seeing kind of the state of the government intervention in all of this.
That's a great idea. David, do you have any comments on that?
Yes, and it has become it's gaining momentum, and Constantine mentioned about California and AB 1103 that was passed, I want to say now, at least 3 years ago or 3.5 years ago by the legislature, and then given over to the policy wonks to kind of put the workings together. And it shows how complex it is, because we're 3.5 years past when it was supposed to go into effect, and it has not yet gone into effect because there's been a great deal of debate and discussion about what the actual working of the law will be. But it is an example of many cities and states that are moving forward in this for disclosure. I think that disclosure, as it works right now, where it's still not totally public, oftentimes it's upon demand. If there's an event, a sale or a lease, then the parties are required to show what their energy numbers are. We're not yet at a point where I think that's going to totally move the market, but I think actually longer term, and obviously we have so much more in the built environment than in new because of the, it's only 2% per year is estimated in new anyway, and in the last 2 to 3 years with the economy where it is, it's been less than that. So it'll take a while to move the market, but I think getting embedded now in building codes, city by city, literally across the country, new environmental requirements for green building, whether it's LEED standards or LEED-like standards in building codes embedded now across the country, over time will have a significant impact. But I do think that the combination of these two things, which have really been kind of done a little bit stealthily, it hasn't gotten a lot of visibility, I think over time they both together have an opportunity to impact the market a great deal.
Well, where are you seeing any of this in retail at all?
Absolutely. I mean, the laws that these gentlemen are talking about impact us the same as they do any other commercial property owner. And typically these laws, if you go through and you read the laws, they're almost all identical in terms of the mechanism. Sometimes they differ in terms of reporting deadlines, whether you report annually or upon some sort of major sale financing or lease event. But yeah, we're subject to the same requirements. Obviously, things can be more difficult for Kimco versus an office owner because of the metering situation. I think that's one of the things that kind of remains to be seen in implementation is how effective, for example, retail property owners are at complying with these laws versus more of a master metered office type environment where the landlord controls the meter and it's much easier to push that information up to the Energy Star database and comply with the law. For example, we have a property out in the Bay Area with 150 tenants on it. And those tenants range from national retailers to, small mom and pop retailers. Well, the prospect of bringing that property into compliance with AB 1103 means that we have to go out and secure 150 individually signed tenant waivers. And the information that's contained in those waivers includes, account numbers, information about operating characteristics within the space, numbers of employees, numbers of cash registers. It's not a small undertaking. And we have, over 100 properties in the state of California. So I think, the devil is really in the details when it comes to implementation, and obviously that's just one of many different components of our patchwork quilt of an energy policy that we have, in the United States. And we could probably do a whole show on renewable energy and just talking about some of the policy trends that are impacting renewables. That's certainly a topic that we're very interested in here at Kimco in terms of developing some renewable capacity. But that's a whole other policy conversation. I think there's a whole other set of regulations that are driving adoption of those types of technologies.
And I'd like to follow on with just a quick comment on what Will said. What we're seeing in California, where the building industry was not at the table as part of these, as the law was being formulated and moving forward, it was really done by the utility companies and by others who had interest in this, and the building industry who had to really implement this were not really there until after it had been passed, and then we're in the policy piece. But I think that speaks to kind of a concern that I have right now, where I know in Boston, various real estate groups are pushing back against disclosure laws. Same thing I think is happening in Chicago and other places, where sometimes the industry, quote unquote, is trying to stop this happening. My view is that disclosure laws are happening. That train has left the station, and they're moving inexorably across most cities and major cities in the country. And so my attitude is that the industry and particularly owners should be part of the process. Because if you're not at the table, the old joke, if you're not at the table, it's possible that you are on the menu. And so in this case, I think that it's more helpful. I think that the industry were playing a proactive role. And I know that's what happened in New York. And I think the New York programs are really more sensible and are probably more practical than some of the things that have happened in some other places. So from my perspective, I think that the industry needs to play an active role, bring up these kinds of issues that Will is kind of describing that we're going to live as well, and be part of the process.
Yeah, and I totally agree with David, and I think that At the end of the day, you know, we as a company, we're doing these things anyway. I mean, we're tracking this information, we're collecting this information, we're trying to improve the performance of our properties when it comes to energy performance and water, you know, performance in other areas. And so, you know, the spirit of the laws is something that is very much in line with what we're trying to do within our own business. And I think it really, as David was saying, comes down, the devil's sort of in the details in terms of the mechanisms of how these disclosure requirements work. And to the extent that they can be relatively low or, you know, very low burden, then it allows us and frees up time on the side of the owner to invest that time and those resources in actually doing something different in the building, as opposed to spending time generating reporting, you know, information and kind of doing the legwork around reporting. We want to be spending that time and money on energy conservation, on renewable energy, on other types of building improvements, and not on compliance.
Constantine, you had something you were going to add, weren't you?
Well, I was just going to kind of echo David's point here that, you know, I think that with these policies, I think that the key has been as much in the process and how they've been adopted and crafted as in terms of, as well as kind of what the actual substance of the policy is. I think New York has been very effective. Our compliance rates are extremely high in terms of the number of buildings that are supposed to report that have been reporting and reporting, you know, effectively. And part of that reason is that the real estate community was brought in very early in the process. You know, it wasn't necessarily always a smooth discussion, and it wasn't always one that everyone came to the same terms on. But, you know, because I think there was a lot of awareness made about this, a lot of education from the city to the kind of various real estate players that would be involved with this and subject to these policies, that it allowed the kind of the introduction and the effectiveness of the disclosure to be much higher than what we've seen in other cities thus far. So I think the process about how these policies are crafted is as important as the substance in some cases.
I just have another tweet from Michael, who's tweeted out, "If you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu," quoted by David Pogue. Yeah, I've never heard that one before, David, but I'm going to use it from now on. Speaking of being on the menu, I have got to take a break for the people who pay the bills around here, after which we are going to talk about where do we go from here? What's going to happen? What are your views on what's going to happen over the next 5, 10 years or longer? And then we'll wrap up the show. So why don't we take a small break?
If you're a retail tenant, you really should belong to the NRTA. They're an organization of the tenants, by the tenants, and for the tenants. Whether you manage a large portfolio or just a mom and pop, the National Retail Tenants Association is on your side. NRTA exists to protect retail tenants everywhere and to make sure landlord billings are correct. Don't wait for your next statement of CAM charges to arrive. Log on to retailtenants.org. That's retailtenants.org. Find out more today.
Okay, welcome back to CRE Radio, and we'd like to wrap up the show with what do you see going on over the next 5, 10 years or so? And that's taking into account that at least I'm going to draw the conclusion that the train has left the station. This is not going to go away. So why don't we start with Constantine? What do you see going on over the next 5, 10 to 20 years? And I think the long-term projection is important because this is all going to take a while.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, I think we're just at the tip of the iceberg. I mean, all this talk about data and all these questions, I mean, we're just starting to collect the very kind of very easy pieces, that kind of the crumbs of what's out there and what's available, and just started to think about better ways of actually collecting and what we and the types of things that we could collect. I mean, we're approaching a situation, a kind of a technical environment where you could start to ask if there's any information you would want to know about your buildings, your portfolio, what would you want to know? And we could start to answer those questions. The technologies exist to be able to do that. It's just going to take a little time to get them implemented. But I'll say that I think that what we're going to see is that
as more data becomes available, very smart people will be able to start running a lot more metrics and analytics on this information. We'll have a lot more reliability in certainty in terms of projections that we're making about energy savings following a retrofit, for example. And I think this is going to really change how the relationship of energy efficiency to the capital markets is currently operating. And I think that's going to shift dramatically, that we'll start to see traditional lenders get much more involved. We'll start seeing a whole new kind of range of investors who are getting involved, who might not just be the socially responsible ones, but kind of traditional investors getting much more attuned to not only energy performance, but other metrics like health and productivity and the kind of things that are really going to make a huge impact, especially if you think about typical office building in New York City might lease for $100 a foot per year. If you could save 30 or 50% of your energy, you might be saving a dollar or two a foot. Now, the flip side is that same office tenant is paying $500 or $600 or $700 a year for the people that are occupying that space. So if you could either increase their productivity, make them happier, make them healthier, so they take less sick days, the returns on that are tremendous. So I think that, we're at a very early stage in the type of data that we're collecting, but that's going to really change the understanding and the analysis that we're able to do. And we're going to be able to start collecting a lot of interesting information about things that right now we don't think we could accurately measure. And I think that's going to change dramatically. And I'd like to just say that, it's very similar analogous to, I think, where commercial real estate was about maybe 20 years ago. I mean, if you think now about CoStar and Real Capital Analytics and all these data providers, they really changed to, kind of the real estate investment and securitization markets and the structured finance markets and all of these tools. And it really came out of the data that allowed people to analyze these investments much closer than they ever had in the past. So I think we're at kind of that similar stage now for energy data and for other kind of sustainability metrics.
Can you see me nodding my head? David.
Well, yeah, I was nodding my head also. Although I might have been nodding off, but I was nodding my head.
No.
This is
I'm so glad you said that.
Because of another issue. Because it took me 14 hours to get home yesterday from New York. That was why. But I agree 100% with what Constantine was saying. We have gone for the last 6 or 7 years. We've had a lot of momentum, and we've had momentum around good ideas and good intentions. And we're at the point where we need something new. And what we need is good data. I totally applaud Constantine's ideas about the whole productivity matter. That's the holy grail. And you're right. If you can save 5% or 10% of your energy, it's peanuts by comparison to the work, the cost of workers and folks in these businesses. So it is a data issue that will drive this, whether it's around economics, whether it's around productivity, et cetera. So the big data piece, I'm 100% on board with. The thing that I would spend a couple minutes just talking about is the whole matter of where social responsibility is going. I'm seeing this sense that we're moving again. I mean, where we started 30 years ago or 40 years ago, where the only responsibility of a company was to make money, and where it's shifted over the last 10 or 15, 20 years, where this whole matter of social responsibility and there's philanthropy involved and trying to do less harm, we're now moving into an area where I see where people are looking to do more good. And there's a number of examples, and I mentioned Walmart, and Walmart has their whole reputation on a variety of things, but that whole opportunity that they're looking to do to develop this scoring process so that a consumer has in front of them the ability to judge this can of peas against that can of peas and make a decision, an informed decision based on sustainable aspects, I think can help drive the market. But others are doing similar sorts of things. Coca-Cola has made a commitment that they're going to be water neutral by 2020. This is not just doing less harm, it's really doing more good. Levi Strauss is working on ways to grow cotton differently with less pesticides and less water and changing that environment. Starbucks is doing some really remarkable things around shade-grown coffee. And so it's this whole movement, and it was led by a Harvard professor, Michael Porter, who has created this whole matter of shared values, where so many of these big companies now are really trying to consider how do they take their own resources, whether it's money or application to some of their processes, and they apply it to the issues that they're concerned about. With Coke, obviously, it's around water, but mostly sustainable kinds of practices. That's what I'm excited about, and that's where I think a lot of the big ideas in corporations are going, is toward this whole matter of shared values. And one of those things that they're concerned about is living and working in sustainable buildings and creating sustainable environments. So, and what will help them get to there is the big data that Constantine talks about. So I think for me, that's an area that I think we need to focus on.
Will.
Last but not least, hopefully.
Yes.
You know, I would say that, again, taking the owner's perspective here, I think that really what I hope to see taking place is a shift that we're seeing in our own business today, which is, you know, a gradual shift from playing defense to playing offense. And what I mean by that is that we started down this road, you know, in a very reactive manner, responding to information requests, responding to disclosure requests, you know, scrambling to start pulling together data and understand how we're performing. And over time, we've been able to get our balance, you know, start to lean forward, start to plan proactively for the future in terms of capital investments and operating investments, and really taking a more planned approach to how we're rolling these programs out. And so what we're doing is in shifting from defense to offense is really shifting from a focus on just measuring to a focus on taking action. And in taking that action, we believe that we are creating real value, not just for our business in terms of economic value, but also in terms of environmental and social value. And I'll give you a little example in closing. When you think about energy consumption at Kimco's property, and you think about the 900 centers that we own and are responsible for, it's literally hundreds of millions of dollars of energy consumption per year. And that's, you know, that's one way of quantifying that. There's obviously an environmental way of quantifying the impact of that energy. But if you think about it as hundreds of millions of dollars of energy consumed a year, and you think about how that breaks down on a typical property, well, about 15% of that is ours. Those are the meters that we control. And those are our common areas and the areas of the property that we're directly responsible for managing. The other 85% of that is what's happening inside of the building, and it's a result of our tenants', you know, day-to-day business operations. And I share that just to say that we think there's a huge opportunity just in the 15%. But over the long term, there's this bigger opportunity around addressing that 85% and understanding what the opportunity is in those tenant spaces to address their impacts. And the real business opportunities that exist, and we've talked a little bit today and mentioned in a couple of different discussion forums, the huge amounts of capital that are out there sitting on the sidelines today, which could be invested to very good use in very reliable, very predictable, positive cash flow type investments in energy efficiency projects. And so over time, I see, you know, a gradual shift out of this defensive measurement mode towards taking action among, you know, the Kimcos of the world, and hopefully among smaller owners as well. And I think there's a lot of different pieces that have to come together, but you're starting to see the forces to align, both in terms of all along kind of the stakeholder continuum, whether it be investors, JV partners, whether it be municipalities, whether it be our tenants. I think those things are starting to align, and I don't think it's going to be the type of thing where we wake up tomorrow and we're living in an instantly different world, but I do think that it will be a gradual shift over time, and that in the end we will have hopefully a much more efficient, much greener set of commercial real estate assets across the U.S. and I think quite likely across the globe.
Gentlemen, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you. I'm very excited about everything that you've been talking about, and excuse me, I am more informed And I'm going to, as I said, there were a bunch of topics that I didn't even get to talk about on today's show that I'm going to set up for different shows, and hopefully each one of you will have an opportunity to be back on the radio with me, and we can talk about that. Why don't we then go and now talk a little bit about, Will, what do you have any speaking engagements coming up, or presentations, or anything that you would like to mention that's coming up on your calendar in the near future?
There's different things coming up. I think the one that I would mention that's coming up here in the next couple of weeks is a forum that's hosted by Chadbourne and Park LLP, which is a law firm down in D.C. And they're hosting a renewable energy forum that's focused on REIT investment and the REIT role, the role of the real estate investment trust in the solar industry and in growing the solar industry. That's a conference that's taking place on the 14th of May. And if you're interested, you can navigate to Chadbourne's website and check that out and register to join. Love to see you there.
Oh, great. And Constantine, what about you?
Well, there's certainly a few things, but I think one that might be of interest that follows on this one is I'm presenting some of the research both on this credit score idea and also on the price impacts of actual energy performance at the Real Estate Research Institute conference, which is going to be held in Chicago. So it's a really interesting group of some of the big investment players and some of the big institutional investors are involved. So that happens, I think, May 1st.
Okay. Oh, that's in the very near future. And David, what about you?
Well, I'm actually appearing. It's like we're on the circuit now.
Take a bow.
I'm going to be participating in a webinar next Tuesday for the conference board on KPIs for sustainability. And then I'm going to be at the IBCON conference with RealCom in Orlando in early June. And then I'm also speaking at the BOMA International Conference in a couple of events there. Including one, the BOMI is actually developing a new sustainability course, a series of courses around for their RPA program. And I was asked about a year ago to participate in helping on that. And so their hope is that they're going to introduce that in the fall of this year. But I'm going to be doing a seminar session at the their international conference in San Diego at the end of June, talking about kind of the state of sustainability and also giving a preview of that course.
Oh, great. Now, for us at CRE Radio, I just want to mention that we have a show coming up next Friday, which is going to be with Ira Meslick and Dave Ezra. We're going to be talking about insurance clauses and to what extent they really protect landlords or tenants. There's a lot of information there that we're going to be talking about that's not so obvious to everybody else. And with that being said, gentlemen, thank you very, very much for being on the show. Lots of information. I'd love to have you back. I hope you had some fun and talking about this, because I did. And I suppose that's not the most important thing, but it's why I kind of love what I do here. And it certainly beats yelling at someone in court. And with that, I would like to thank everybody else who's listening, and we will see you or hear from you in another week on our other show. Roger, would you please take it away?
This has been CRE Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a topic you would like to discuss, Howard can be reached at 949-288-3707. That's area 949-288-3707. Or by email to howard@creradio.com. CRE Radio is a live and recorded radio show accessible from both the web and your smartphone. Visit creradio.com to download any broadcast anytime or to receive newsletters and updates from Howard. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented on an informational basis only, with the sole intent of educating our listeners. Howard and his guest conversations specifically do not intend to offer legal advice. If you need legal advice, we recommend you seek out your own counsel. Remember, laws and practices may vary from state to state. Please listen again next time to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Unauthorized editing or copying of portions of the show without the express written consent of CRE Radio is strictly prohibited. All rights reserved.
And that's a wrap.